Thomas Starr King, who was both a Universalist and a Unitarian 100 years before the two merged, famously summed them up this way. The one thinks God is too good to damn them forever. The other thinks they are too good to be damned forever. I think he kind of had the number of both of those. Universalists did indeed affirm that God would not have created us only to damn us to the eternal torments of hell, as the dominant Calvinist theology of the time held. Our Creator, they said, was love personified, and God's boundless love would not permit such suffering. No matter what we had done, God would have mercy on us. Well, that's God, but you don't have to have a divine capacity for love in order to practice mercy. Mercy is a humbler achievement, and I believe it's within the reach of even us flawed, vengeful human beings. But it's not always easy to extend mercy to others or ourselves. I find that in order to talk about what mercy is and isn't, it's very revealing to look at how the Bible deals with this. It talks about mercy a lot in various contexts. People asking God's mercy upon us when he is angry. Hailing how Jesus is gaining mercy for us through his sacrificial death, which the Universalists rewrote quite a bit, and that's the version that we saw in the version of A Balm in Gilead. That we sang, Jesus more as a heroic human than God's sacrifice. The Bible explains that God shows mercy because he is a God of justice, pairing those two concepts in a way that we still do. And in a passage beloved by many of the liberal religious, including me, it's on the walls of more than one Unitarian Universalist church, there is the sixth chapter of Micah, verse 8. Which says, "What does the Lord require of you, O humanity, but that you do justice and love mercy and walk humbly with your God?" But, and I know this may surprise many U.S. Americans, the Bible was not written in English. And it turns out that where the word mercy appears in the King James Version, the one that we know most often, it is referring to one of several Hebrew or Greek words. And these words might be better translated variously as compassion, love, grace, forgiveness. The word used in Micah, chesed, is generally and probably more accurately translated as loving kindness. The word that means closer to what I think of as mercy is rachamim, and that appears elsewhere and often in prayers. Chesed, loving kindness. So the New Revised Standard Version translates that famous passage as to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God. Quite a different command. I think the challenge to translators doesn't just come from the doubt about what the authors meant who were writing it in Greek and Hebrew and what the context was there, but doubt about what we mean in English. What is mercy? How is it different from all those other things like compassion and love? What do we even mean by that? I'd like to think about what it means to have mercy by first distinguishing it from some of these common synonyms. So what are we talking about when someone needs mercy? Brian Stevenson talks about extending mercy, especially to the undeserving. I would say that undeserving place is particularly where mercy comes in. Someone needs mercy when they have done wrong, caused harm, or simply fallen short of an ideal. And justice is called for, but they ask also for mercy, something that perhaps they do not deserve but need. And thus we talk about the need to balance justice with mercy. And that issue is rich and complex, and I will talk about it sometime. And it raises as well the very deep and complicated issues of criminal justice and where mercy fits into that system, which I may also talk about another time. And then the whole question of whether we turn too easily to such things as mercy and forgiveness when justice has not yet been done. All rich ways of engaging this topic, but they're not my topic today. I want to look at forgiveness. That is not what I mean by mercy. Forgiveness asks a lot. If I have hurt you and I say forgive me, I am asking a great deal more of you than if I simply ask for mercy. For mercy, for one thing, it admits that there is something I do not deserve. There is something I don't deserve, but please have mercy on me. Make some room for me. And you could do that without going as far as forgiving me. And then there's compassion, used almost interchangeably sometimes with mercy. To me, that's pretty demanding as well. And also, compassion is a feeling. It's an understanding. To have compassion for somebody is to sit in their seat, to walk in their shoes, and understand something about what they are feeling, to feel together with them. I don't think you have to understand that in order to extend mercy to someone. You might say pity, which I think Blake in the hymn we sang uses a little differently maybe than we use it nowadays. Anyway, I'll come back to that hymn, but pity I think of as a sort of minimal compassion. It's a little condescending. It's the bare minimum of fellow feeling. But it still is about feeling, like compassion. And I don't think mercy is about how we feel. It's about what we do. It's about, despite whether I understand your feelings or think I would ever share them, can see things from your point of view, I am going to extend this to you. That is what mercy asks of us. It's all it asks of us. It's not a small all. All it asks of us is that we permit some space, some room. Room to err, first of all. Room to make mistakes. Room to have been wrong and to be wrong again, to do wrong again. It's a recognition of imperfection. I think here, lest I get too abstract, we should all just take a moment. It's probably not hard to think of a time you've been wronged, but it's probably better at this moment just to think in private of a time you have done wrong or hurt someone. It can be big or very small. And just think about what you needed at that moment. When you've harmed someone, some justice is called for, some fairness, yes, to restore balance. And if you've needed mercy, it seems to me that what you are asking for is a second chance. Let me try again. Let me do it better. And without that space, none of us could draw breath. As Brian Stevenson said in that reading, we're all broken in some way. It is what we share, one of the things we share. We are all broken. We all make these mistakes. So how am I to move on from having harmed you, from having let you down? And it comes up in the centering words we heard as well, J.R.R. Tolkien, Gandalf reminding Frodo that while we may seek justice, none of us get exactly what we deserve. There are many who deserve life that we cannot give life to, so what is it that we need beyond what we simply deserve? Because mercy acknowledges the inevitability, the humanity of error, the fact that it is our basic human quality that we are broken, that we make mistakes, that we do things wrong, it allows the possibility of growth and change. Risk. I mean, who would take a risk if there were going to be no mercy when we messed up? And because it allows these things, it is what makes relationships possible. Just imagine, if you even can, a friendship with someone who cannot permit you to do wrong, who cannot sustain the friendship after the first hurt done. Imagine a marriage built like that. Imagine a job with those expectations. You wouldn't last a month. Blake is such a mysterious poet. He's the poet behind that song, Mercy, Pity, Peace, and Love. And then his language was different even from people of his time, much less from us a couple of hundred years later. But when I think of those four things, I think of his pity as that modicum of understanding, that maybe not as far as what I think of as pity or compassion, but just an understanding that we are both human. That is what allows for mercy. Pity makes mercy possible. And mercy, because it allows a relationship to continue, to resume after mistakes, it is what makes love possible. And then it is from love that so much of our peace flows. So mercy comes from pity and then gives us love and peace. What if we embraced mercy as an active recognition, an act of recognition, that we are all flawed, that we are all imperfect, that we hurt others, that we fail others, all of us, and must be given room for that, must be given room to begin again after that, because without that, there can be no human relationships. Now, most of our failings don't carry dire consequences. We move on without too much difficulty. Sometimes they do. Sometimes because of the magnitude of what we have done, or simply bad timing, fate. Bearing the full weight forever of the things that happen to us, because of our mistakes, because of others' mistakes, because of the wrongs people make. Trying to carry that weight would make life impossible. Mercy loosens the grip on us of these consequences. Loosens it enough for us to draw breath. That great word, respiration, which has as its root the same as inspiration, the same as spirit. It's the same in Hebrew, the word ruach means spirit and means by extension God. The breath within us is the spirit of the holy. You know, at times our actions just take us down a narrowing passage of possibility. We can feel the walls closing in. We're on this track and it's just getting harder and harder to go any other way because of the decisions we've made in the past. If we got only what we deserve, if we reaped only the rigid consequences of what we had done, who could endure it? Who could endure those rigid constraints? Mercy moves beyond what we deserve and lets us breathe deeply and exhale and breathe again. And the walls expand, the passage becomes widened. It lets us turn back. It lets us turn in another direction. It lets us change our way. It lets us change our ways. I want to credit Mary with this because she put it in my mind as we talked about this amazing topic, the connection between mercy and the conversations we seek and often fail to have in our political world right now. There's so much ink spilled, so many pixels expended on our growing polarization. How I feel it, how I fear it, is as a growing rigidity, a rigidity of each position, my own, other people's, like each of us is in a box with an increasingly thickening wall, and there's so little room to breathe or stretch or grow. And what mercy might offer as we say things to one another that are hard to forgive or understand, what mercy might offer is a little bit more room to wander and get lost and be found again, to wander away from the positions we've taken up. And I know why we don't often extend that mercy. What we fear when somebody says, when they go low, you go high, you know, rise above it, be better. Extend some mercy to someone in their own box. I think we're afraid, we have this clenching fear that if we give them an inch, they'll take a mile. And sometimes people do. Sometimes when we seek to make room for somebody, they just take up all the room. And it's a reasonable fear that things will not improve, our conversation will not move forward, just because we extend some room to try again. Maybe we focus too much on other people, on what we want to change about them. Maybe if we try to bring mercy into our lives, we should focus less on those we would have to extend mercy to, others, and more on ourselves. I don't think we're real merciful to ourselves either, oftentimes. So can we extend mercy to ourselves? Can we say, you know, you get another chance at this. You know, you mess up sometimes. It's okay. It's okay. Just let's try again. Not even forgiveness. Not even perhaps compassion, although those things are important to extend to ourselves. But just the awareness that we err and that we need room to turn another way. I've been having a lot of interesting conversations with folks, with friends and colleagues and members of the congregation about white supremacy culture, as it's called. It can be a helpful way to frame it, to take our minds a little off, what you think of white supremacy, the people with the torches and the white robes, and even to just set us off to one side for a moment, what white supremacy is, the underlying belief and all the ways that our culture enacts it, that whiteness is the best thing, that whiteness is the pinnacle. And just looking at some of the markers that go along with that culture, because it is the culture that we all swim in. You don't have to be white. You don't have to be a white supremacist to be in this culture. And nor are the qualities I'm about to relate, they're not necessarily evil, but I'll get back to that. Some of them are the factors in white supremacy culture: perfectionism, a belief that there's only one right way. There's a sense of urgency to white supremacist culture. You know, many people in our culture, especially people of color, are saying, you know, that's not the only way to think. And maybe that goes in hand with this white supremacy. You've got to get it right. You've got to get it right now. And there's only one right. Get it right the first time. It's very rigid. There's no room to mess up. One strike and you are out. Now, not all of these qualities are necessarily bad or oppressive by themselves. A sense of urgency is very appropriate in certain times. A belief in only one right way is maybe too rigid, but it can drive us to find the right way, a right way, to discern morally what we need to do. But that particular worldview that is reinforced by and reinforces an oppressive system, well, you can see how. It's really hard to budge, you know? Oh, we can't stop and have this conversation. We can't stop and think. We've got to figure it out right now. We've got to keep moving. There's only one right way. We're on the right path. There's tremendous pressure to this. How do you turn that thing around? Well, mercy might be a start. Say, it's okay. You don't have to be perfect. It's crazy to think that anybody could be perfect. No, there's not one right way. No, we don't have to figure it all out right now. We're going to keep doing it. We're going to keep going through iterations of what is the way we want to be together. We don't have to keep going down the narrowing path we're on. None of us move through this world without occasionally or frequently failing others, doing harm, sometimes in really big ways. Sometimes the mercy that you receive might be you have been freed from prison after committing a crime. And sometimes the mercy might be that person in your family whom you love but you snapped at is willing to talk to you and love you again a moment later. We all do these things in small and large ways, in visible and invisible ways, but it's universal. We all need second chances, and third and fourth and 10,000th chances. None of us, to quote something else that Bryan Stevenson says in his wonderful book, none of us can be reduced to the worst thing we have done. None of us can be reduced to the worst moment of our lives. Mercy opens that space. Opens up a little breathing room, says, I see your flaws and your possibilities. You're human. Being human hurts, and it hurts others, and there is a way forward from here. We meet each other with so many judgments. Often, the judgments that others turn upon us, or the judgments we turn upon ourselves, are the first ones that we turn on others, and we meet each other with that judgmental attitude. How would it be to temper that with mercy? A simple acknowledgement. I know that you are more than what I am judging you for. I know that you are more than I have thus far understood. Let us try. Let us live in that more spacious world. Let us try to extend each other, try to extend ourselves mercy, and see how it feels to breathe deep. May it be so.